Welcome to Money for the Rest West Plus. This is Dependent episode 160. Ethical consumption is a myth. It is Saturday morning, June 10th. Recording here in the bunker of our crawl space. I've been meaning to, and hopefully when I get done here, I'm going to upload a photo of where I record the podcast and the other plus content. Have a crawl space of this house that has the best acoustics. And I, the more I do the show and the plus membership, the more sensitive I am to the sound quality. And I just like the sound in here, even though it's kind of dank. And they sort of partially dug out this crawl space because they had wanted to expand. And so I have this huge wall of dirt next to me that's covered in plastic. Anyway, you'll go on the Money for the Rest of Us Facebook and you will find a picture of that. So in speaking of the podcast, next week, hopefully 161, unless I come up with something else more interesting between now and then, doing a show on retirement calculators. And I've looked at some of the, at least the ones I found that have seemed like the leading calculators, but it's such a wide area. So if you have a favorite retirement calculator in terms of figuring out how much you need, how much you're saving now, how big a nest egg that will create, and how much income potentially that will generate in retirement, go ahead and email me or email me. We can find JD at moneyfortherestofus.com. And let me know what you're using. So I'm planning on sort of profiling various calculators, hopefully take some principles, things we should look for in calculator. I don't know where it's going, but just kind of was sort of an exercise that was suggested by Robert. It was a great suggestion. So I'm going to take a look at that. In terms of changes to the website, a couple months ago, we have the model portfolios, and then I added some model portfolios for commission-free exchange-traded funds for Fidelity, as well as, I guess, some non-transaction funds, commission-free ETFs, I guess it was. And as soon as I did it, Fidelity changed their list. And so I've been meaning to get back to it. And what I actually ended up doing, and this was a suggestion by Jack, is I put together, it's Module 5, Lesson 6. Basically, there's a new substitute page or an alternative page. And so if you look at the model portfolios, there's a version for substitute holdings, for alternative holdings, if you are a client at Vanguard, using some of their ETFs and funds. There's some alternatives for Fidelity, and then there's some alternatives for others. So because, for example, Vanguard and Fidelity, they don't have master limited partnerships. And so I don't include them as an option there. And so instead of saying, okay, here's the Vanguard model portfolio, instead we're going to go back and say, here are the model portfolios. Here are the holdings, or the example holdings within those model portfolios. Notice I almost said recommended. I don't give advice. I don't recommend, but here are some example holdings within the model portfolios. And then if for whatever reason you can't access it or you want to do it on a no transaction fee basis, then you can go to Module 5, Lesson 6, which will show alternative holdings within the Vanguard Fidelity platform, or and then some other examples of other alternative holdings, such as the MLP and the bank loan space. So that's new in terms of what's there. One thing to keep in mind, though, particularly on the bond side, is there's not always a great alternative on the fixed income side. And the model portfolios are using Double Line as the fixed income fund and NEAR as a short-term, this is iShares short-term bond ETF. Those have characteristics that I like in terms of their SEC yield, their yield to maturity, and their duration profile in terms of their interest rate sensitivity. There's a nice balance between, for example, the iShares short-term bond ETF has a duration of less than half a year, so 0.47, yet it's yielding close to 1.3, 1.4%. Some of the options on Fidelity and Vanguard, they have yields like that, but the duration, the interest rate sensitivity is much higher. And the same for the intermediate bond space. The Vanguard's total market bond fund has a duration of closer to 6 versus double line, which is closer to 4. And so there's less interest rate sensitivity with the double line fund. So while there are alternatives, they're not necessarily perfect replacements for what's in the model portfolio. So just that to note. About a month ago, Nicholas asked me a question that I never quite got to, and it was on what is the size of the U.S. 401k market? This is the defined contribution market within the U.S. relative to other, just so to the overall size, for example, the stock market or the bond market. And this is some data, and I'll link to it in the notes, from Investment Company Institute. We're going to look at overall retirement assets. So U.S. retirement market has about $25.3 trillion in assets. And that's broken down as follows. So within the 401k, that's about $7 trillion. There is $7.9 trillion in what individual retirement accounts. So these are also tax-deferred vehicles. So if you are invested in a work defined contribution plan through your employer, when you leave, you can roll it over into an individual retirement account, which is also a tax-deferred vehicle. And so that's about $7.9 trillion. So, and then within traditional defined benefit plans or pension plans, private sector, about $2.9 trillion in assets. Public sector, government plans, I assume that includes probably the federal government, $5.5 trillion. And then they have what are called annuity reserves, which would be, I assume, insurance assets that are held for annuities that individuals might hold. So that's combined as $25.3 trillion. Now, how does that compare relative to the overall U.S. stock market? Well, the U.S. stock market capitalization, which is the number of shares outstanding times the price, is around $26 trillion. That's an estimate by Ned Davis Research. And then the U.S. bond market is bigger than the stock market. So U.S. bond market's about $39.3 trillion. And by bond market, that includes treasuries, which are around $14 trillion, municipal bonds, about $4 trillion, mortgage-related bonds, about $8.9 trillion, there's about $8.5 trillion in corporate debt, another $2 trillion in federal agency securities, such as Fannie Mae, and looks like $884 billion in money market funds and another $1.4 trillion in asset-backed securities. And all together, that adds up to about $39.4 trillion. So the bond market is bigger than the stock market combined. I actually didn't add those together, but it looks like that's around $65 trillion in terms of total U.S. stock and bond market capitalization, which is what retirement assets, most retirement assets are invested in. So roughly $25 trillion, so is that 40% of the total market capitalization of stock and bonds in the U.S. is retirement assets. And to Nicholas' original question, $7 trillion are 401k plans. Got a number of emails recently on Bitcoin. I did an episode of the regular podcast in April 2015 on Bitcoin. It was episode 53. I did a plus episode that same time where I talked about how I bought Bitcoin. I did not buy much. I bought $3,000 or $4,000 worth, I think, at the time, and which could be a lot, I guess, depending on your perspective, given the risk. And then I sold it in January 2016, and I discussed that in plus episode 91. So I bought it about $230 per Bitcoin, and I sold around $400. And I sold because of some controversy that I'll discuss in a minute. I'm going to provide a brief overview of Bitcoin because it's been a long time if you're not familiar with it. But a year later, so earlier this year, Bitcoin was $835, so it had doubled since I sold it. Feel some regret there, but not as much regret as I feel that it's now selling for $2,930 per Bitcoin, so it has tripled this year. And we're going to talk a little bit about regret because I had a good reason to sell, and I still have a real little bit, but had I kept it, That would have been nice. But first off, Bitcoin, this is a cryptocurrency. And episode 53 I discuss it. And if you want something even more recent, while I was biking the other day, the Tim Ferriss podcast interviewed Nick Szabo, and they discussed cryptocurrency and Bitcoin at length for 2.5 hours. I did not listen to all 2.5 hours, but I got a good hour of it in. And so it's kind of a nice overview, and they go into some interesting things. But Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency, so it's a digital currency, and you can store it, or you can use it to pay for transactions. And there's what's interesting about it is all the historic transactions related to Bitcoin are kept on a ledger called the blockchain. And there are individual components of this blockchain called blocks. And these blocks are about they're 1 megabit in size, and they contain the transactions that occurred within about a 10-minute period of time. And so the blockchain is the record of every transaction that has ever occurred with Bitcoin, from somebody sending somebody Bitcoin and getting Bitcoin back or paying for something. That's all, that the entire history is there, and it's irreversible. And so there's a history. Now, it's, and you can't necessarily tell who was involved specifically, because it lists out the public keys and private keys, and I won't get into that aspect of it. But there's these blocks of transactions. And what's interesting about it is you have what are called miners. And miners are essentially computers around the world that are solving a solvable mathematical problem. And so they solve this problem. At the same time, they're verifying the transactions in this particular block. So they verify the transactions. And you have all these miners around verifying the transaction in a particular block while at the same time trying to solve a problem, this math problem, and whoever solves the math problem first gets a Bitcoin, I actually forget the amount, but they get a small percentage of Bitcoin. So they get paid for their efforts. So everybody's competing to verify transactions, so you get multiple verifications, but whoever solves the problem first, who has the most computing power, ends up getting the Bitcoin. And so it sounds really kind of silly when you explain it, but that's how it works. And so what's interesting is back in January 2016, there was an issue where the network, there was only a certain amount of capacity. In other words, as you get more and more transactions, for example, in June of 2017, there were 287,000 transactions per day. And so you can only fit so many transactions in one block. And so if there's a lot of transactions, then you start to get into basically a traffic jam, right? Because you have people waiting to get their transaction, because these blocks are only verified every 10 minutes. And then the blocks get added to what's called the blockchain, or this ongoing ledger. And so there's an article in, I think it was in Coinbase, that I'll link to, that says future growth, however, is limited due to Bitcoin's current block size maximum, which is 1 megabit or megabyte, I guess. Current block size maximum and transaction size minimum, leading to a ceiling on the number of new transactions that can be added to its blockchain per day, one that Bitcoin has now nearly reached. And they point out that increased transactions have led Bitcoin blocks to average 92% of their 1 megabyte capacity. And so they're nearing capacity. And in order to, and this has been going on. So when I sold my Bitcoin, this was the issue. And they need to change the code, but this is a distributed network, so there's nobody in charge. And so there needs to be enough agreement among all the various miners that are involved to change the underlying code to increase the size of the transactions. And it's not happened. And And what has happened instead is that the miners, many of them, and back in January 2016, 50% of the hash power, the ability to mine and verify transaction, was concentrated with just says two miners. So two miners in China controlled 50% of the processing power. And this article mentioned, I don't know how much more distributed it is now, but this particular article mentioned 95% of the hashing power was controlled by a handful of guys sitting on a single stage. So there must have been a Bitcoin conference. But it's fairly concentrated. But there doesn't seem to be an agreement to actually increase the transaction size. And as a result, mainly because now people are paying the miners to get their transaction verified. So if you have a transaction, you want it verified and get it part of the blockchain, the cost, the average transaction fee grew 155% in the first quarter of 2017 to 62 cents. But now, as recently as last week, it was up to $5 per transaction. And so it could cost more to get a transaction verified than it is to use a credit card, which sort of defeats one of the purposes of Bitcoin. And so they've never solved this problem. And there were articles in January 2016 that Bitcoin is dead. But it continues to grow. And I wonder, and I don't have any verification of this, is one reason the price keeps going up is because it is, within China, one of the few ways you could potentially get money out of China if you're trying to get capital out of there or Venezuela or other places. And so, because there's no record, right? There's no record of who's moving it. All you have are these public and private keys. So that's what's going on in Bitcoin. I feel a little bit of regret that I sold. On the other hand, I think I had good reasons to sell because of this ongoing controversy that this distributed network was being controlled by a handful of people, and they were basically taking fees, and they didn't want to change the code, and now they're taking even more fees and not changing the code, and it's still not been resolved. As part of that, though, so that's I wouldn't invest in Bitcoin right now, but then again, there's a part of me that says maybe I should invest in Bitcoin, because if there's a limited supply and there's still a great deal of demand from those that want to move capital in a anonymous way, you could continue to see the price go up. But there's no way to know that. There just really isn't. Another version of cryptocurrency that I know very, very little about, but I was looking at, is something called Ethereum, whose price has gone from $10 at the beginning of this year to $278. Now, it's a little different than Bitcoin. It has a public blockchain network. It has bytes, etc. But its purpose is different. And I'll link to an Ethereum for Beginners article. And I'm going to read for that. It says, Bitcoin and Ethereum differ substantially in purpose and capability. Bitcoin offers one particular application of blockchain technology, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system that enables online Bitcoin payments. That's what Bitcoin does. While the Bitcoin blockchain is used to track ownership of digital currency, the Ethereum blockchain focuses on running the programming code of any decentralized application. In the Ethereum blockchain, instead of mining for Bitcoin, miners work to earn Ether, a type of crypto token that fuels the network. So basically, it's a distributed computing network to build applications, and that's sort of how it works. And so you don't necessarily use, and you still have miners that get paid in Ethereum. And now, why is Ethereum up from $10 to $250 per Ether? I have no idea, because you're not necessarily paying with things with this, but it's used to run these distributed applications. And that's about all I know on Ethereum right now. Compared to that, gold just seems way, way simpler, doesn't it? So finally, I got an email from a member. He writes, I just sold $20,000 in shares of the company I work for. I've noticed you are not warning, but are yourself not placing any further into stocks in the past few updates, investment conditions reports. My takeaway from that is to keep what's there, but now is not necessarily the time to add stocks. My long-term plan is to keep my money where it is. I have a ridiculous 15% return on my robo-advisor investment, and let me tell you, did weed stocks ever crash? But I never put that much in there anyway. Yeah, apparently the stocks related to marijuana crashed in the past few weeks. And that's the thing about investing. There's just so many different things. You just can't keep track of all the different ways to invest, which is why I like to focus on asset classes. So He goes on, my current strategy is to dump about 50% of my monthly income into the robo-advisor and any lump sums I invest myself following the aggressive model portfolios. Well, I'm gleaning from you that I should dry up my auto deposits for a while until a correction or conditions become more favorable. Therefore, my lump sum might be better taken outside of the bounds of the aggressive portfolio. Are these reasonable thoughts? So he's correct. I've not invested more in stocks, and it's not because I think the market is going to crash. I have the same data you have. We have the investment conditions report. Conditions are neutral. And then we have the expected returns. Now, we've gone for months without any type of sell-off in terms of the stock market. I don't know when that's going to occur. So I have no insight into where the market is going. And in a condition of neutral investing, a disciplined investment plan would be to continue to invest and deposit and to dollar cost average in. In my situation, I just haven't done it because I probably am not as disciplined as investor as I should be. And I prefer to invest in a way where I feel that, how should I put this? I want to feel really good when I invest. I don't need to be in the stock market. So I'm not saving for retirement anymore. So that's the thing. I'm not in the accumulation phase. I'm in a maintenance phase. So I have this nest egg, and certainly my time horizon is 30 years, but the opportunity cost for me of not being in the market is not very low, whereas somebody that's accumulating and you're saving for retirement and you have a much longer time horizon than I do, then it makes sense to continue to invest in the market until conditions get red. And they're not. They're yellow. And so the market, there's very good cases for why the market could continue to go up. And I talked about that in the investment conditions report. You see valuations actually improving for the MSCI All Country World Index global stocks as earnings have rebounded. And so in that environment, one should continue to invest in stocks. Now, in my personal portfolio, I've invested, I mentioned, in Wonder Capital. I've been putting more money with Pier Street. We put an offer on a house the other day, not to move. Somebody asked me whether I'm an impulsive buyer. Or I'm not an impulsive buyer, but we are somewhat impulsive when it comes to buying houses that we want to restore, because that's what LaPro likes to do. And so this was a house in our neighborhood that would be an excellent rental property, and it's close to us, and it would work out very well. We made an offer. They turned it down. And so, but the bottom line is I'm always looking, but I'm not necessarily spending all my time thinking about investing and feeling compelled to put money to work. So I have no insight at whether the market's going to fall or not. Probabilities would say the market's going to go up because it usually does, and conditions are neutral for that. But when I look at expected returns and I look at the strong returns year to date, I mean, I looked again, maybe I should put more money in emerging markets small cap. And then I saw that it's already up 30% year to date. And so there's a part of me that says wait for a pause and in at least some type of sell-off, but I don't know when that will occur. So he's correct. You can't necessarily, I'm not even going to say do what I say, not what I do, because I think you can look at it both ways. It depends on your phase of life and it depends on the size of your portfolio. And in my situation, I have a very low hurdle in terms of expected return in the sense that I'm just trying to get 5% or so return. And I'm very comfortable having cash and waiting to where for I feel there's a better opportunity. But in the end, I would probably would be better off just having just invested and gone back in and put more in the stock market, but I haven't done it. So, but I'm looking at the same data you are in terms of investment conditions, and they're neutral. They're neutral right now, would suggest a disciplined approach, stick to your long-term target allocation, continuing to invest money. And I will leave it at that. Have a great weekend.